to episode 46 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here with my discerning co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Thank you, Perry. Yes, it's nice to be back again, back at the mic again, and talking to our listener out there.
Yeah, back at the microphone, back in lockdown.
Oh dear, and we are unfortunately back in lockdown. But these short, sharp, hard lockdowns are probably the way to keep on top of it, I think.
I think so. Looks like I missed out on being one of the secondary contacts for somebody that had the virus.
Oh, goodness.
They were at a place that I was in. I'd left there 10 minutes before they turned up.
Oh wow.
So I was a bit lucky about that, but
indeed,
these things happen. If you head around the city as you do when you're just basically going about your everyday stuff, you're going to run across some situations where you may end up having to be tested, but not as yet.
No.
But anyway,
which is why we all wear masks, isn't it?
Which is why we all wear masks, and that's right. And I was at the Queen Victoria Market in Melbourne on Thursday, and somebody came in just a bit after we left. But it's all masks down there at the Vic Market, so you have to wear one of those around all over the place. And it's obviously doing a heck of a lot of good for all of us, and so we'll just keep on going and keep on doing that. That's the best.
Absolutely.
We'll just keep on carrying on, and but we're halfway through that lockdown, and by the time some of the listeners will listen to this, we'll be hopefully well and truly out of it.
Let's hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we've got a bit of bad news overnight. A friend to the science fiction field in Melbourne by the name of Yvonne Rousseau passed away on the weekend. I knew her. I wasn't a great friend of hers. She was the partner of a good friend of ours, John Foister, for a long period of time, up until his death, and that was in 2003, David.
Gosh, yeah.
It doesn't seem that long ago,
no.
But it's 18 years ago now. Mm. It's unbelievable. Anyway, so Yvonne had a lot of close contact with a lot of people inside the SF field and certainly in Melbourne and in Adelaide, where she lived. Bruce Gillespie, friend of the podcast, put a note up on Facebook yesterday or Saturday night. I can't remember. It might have been last night even. With a few notes about it, and I've decided that I'd basically read some of the things that he had to say about Yvonne. She was a life member of the Victorian Society of Editors, and she was the author of The Murders at Hanging Rock. That was a book about the film and the book of the Hanging Rock episode. She published several short stories and also wrote many penetrating critical and personal articles. She was a member of the collective that published the Australian Science Fiction Review second series back in the 90s, and she was a contributor to Australian Science Fiction Review, SF Commentary, and many other publications. And our thoughts go out to her family and friends. And I know that a number of our friends were close friends of hers. Mm. And so our sympathies go out to all of them. It's unfortunate, David, that as we get older, we are going to be coming across this more and more. John Bankson last year, and now Yvonne this year. They won't be the last, but we've just got to, it's part of life. We just have to basically work our way through it and just carry on.
Yep.
That's all we can do.
Indeed.
So moving on from there onto other science fiction matters, things that I wanted to discuss before we get on to our main part of the program here today, and that is to mention the Locust magazine recommended reading list for 2020. That always comes out at the beginning of February, and I think it probably came out between the time we recorded our last episode and we actually published it.
Mm-hmm.
And put it up and made it available. But the Locust Science Fiction and Fantasy recommended reading list, and we'll put the link into the show notes later. This is the major newsletter, or Locus is the major newsletter of the science fiction field. And it has a large number of correspondents who do their reviewing for them. And at the end of each particular year, they get them all to, get them together electronically to come up with a list of their favorite works in the field. Now, this is a massive undertaking because there's a large amount of stuff. They were talking about the fact that they looked at something in the vicinity of 900 titles all up across all the different categories to come up with their final lists. And I'm not going to go through all the lists because they're all very, very long, but they have recommendations for things such as SF novels, fantasy novels, horror, young adult, first novels, collections, anthologies, novellas, short stories. It goes on and on and on and on. It covers all the different parts of all the field. It is huge. You really do have to have a look at it to see what's there. Now, I find this very, very useful because it helps me to be able to determine what sort of stuff I should look at in terms of nominations for the Hugo Awards. It's not the only thing I look at, but it's one of the major things. And it's also interesting to have a look at how well, it gives you an opportunity to have a look at how the SF publishing field went in 2020. And as we know, it wasn't the greatest year for that. Probably okay for publishing, not very good for book selling unless you were online, because a lot of the bookshops were shut, the physical ones anyway. But it's interesting just to have a look at sometimes how the flow of publishing goes. And I did a count for the last couple of years for the number of recommendations they had in just three categories. SF novels, in 2020, they recommended 28, and that's down from 32 the year before. Fantasy novels, 28 again for 2020, also down from 30. But the big drop was in novellas. They went down from 34 in 2019 to only 19 this time. Now, I've extolled the virtues of novellas in the past on this podcast, basically putting the point that I think that's one of the areas where it's a good way to get an idea of what an author's like and what sort of work they can do. The novella has a tendency to concentrate the mind of the writer just in one particular thread, and they can do that very, very well in 120 odd pages. As you recall, a novella is like 17,500 words to about 40,000. So a short novel. So 60 pages to 120, 130, somewhere around there. Gives you a really good idea about what a particular author is like. And I've been using this particular list over the last month to, well, the last couple of weeks that it's been up, but I've also been looking at other ones that they've mentioned from time to time in the magazine, and to have a look at what I'm going to nominate for the Hugo Awards. And I would have a bit of a chat about that in a couple of episodes' time. Not just ready just as yet, but we shall get there sometime soon. But I can recommend the recommended reading list. I think it's a very good resource, and it's just unfortunate that there are other genres that we look at, and one of them we're going to be looking at today, where it's actually hard to find any other sort of genre magazine that does anything similar to this. And I think the science fiction and fantasy community is very well served by Locus Magazine in this regard.
Indeed, and it's been going for decades, hasn't it?
Well, this is about the 50th year of the recommended reading list, I believe. I think they started sometime. I think the magazine started in the
Yeah,
60s
that sounds right.
under Charlie Brown, and I think that he started up his recommended reading list probably around the late 60s or early 70s. I think that this is the 50th Locus Awards because they also have a reader awards where you can vote on your favourite novel, novella, short story, and they hand out awards later on in the year as well. It's one of the big three, in my view, after the Hugo and the Nebula, and very worthwhile watching and having a look at and keeping an eye on. So that's all the initial natter for this episode, I think, David. I think we're done.
So we're going to do crime today, I believe.
So I believe.
Crime is one of those genres which is a little bit fluid. There are some sort of soft edges to it, I think. So I've taken advantage of that today, and in the books that I've chosen to talk about. But it's the same way that science fiction sort of merges a bit into fantasy. There's sort of a mixed area in between science fiction, clear science fiction, and clear fantasy. And it's the same really with crime and thrillers. I think they overlap a lot. It's pretty pointless trying to distinguish between them. So that's what would you say? You're looking skeptical, Perry.
No, 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 no. I'm just basically sort of screwing up my face because I have a tendency to agree with you. I think
Oh,
that
okay.
I think if we just basically use crime as like a big overall genre, a bit like science fiction just takes in all of those wider areas, sub-genres, if you like, of horror, YA, fantasy, urban fantasy, military science fiction, all of it. Same thing with crime. If you take in spy thrillers, cozy mysteries, locker room mysteries, and we have one of those there here today, and just sometimes there's almost not a crime committed, but it's close enough to being a crime to be committed that it's a big wide field.
Yeah, it is a big wide field. It's pretty pointless trying to get too fussed about the taxonomy of all the various subgenres you can invent.
No, I
So,
think that's right, and I think that if you basically go with the idea that you think it's a crime novel, it probably is.
yeah.
What's that great line about the definition of science fiction? Science fiction is what I point at and call that science
When I
fiction.
say that words, yeah, that's right. That's
Yeah,
right.
that's right. And
Yeah.
so if you could say that, it's almost the same for for crime fiction. So we have it. We look at these things as being a very wide, inclusive church,
Oh,
don't we,
indeed,
Dan?
indeed, indeed. Okay, so what have you been reading in this genre, Perry?
Well, I've looked at a book from the first one I want to look at today is a book called Blacktop Wasteland by a writer called S.A. Crosby. This, I believe, is his third novel. Came out, well, in 2020, got a lot of good press and reviews, and ended up on a few people's best crime novels of the year. I'm not so sure, but anyway, it's a great title, Blacktop Wasteland. It's a really good title. Now, there's a line in a Springsteen song, which I can never remember which one it is, that runs, "I had debts no honest man could pay." It's a good line, but it fits this book perfectly because basically the main character, Beauregard Montage, she's known as Bug because Beauregard is, just a bit too long. He's really two different men. At the same time, he's the loving husband and father, car mechanic and street racer. So he runs a car mechanic shop, looking after and hotting up cars, doing his work, doing the work there. But he also is a street racer at night. Again, very much a sort of a Springsteen character in that way. But he's also done a bit of work in the past as a getaway driver. And if you remember the film Drive with Ryan Gosling, it's a bit like that in the sense that he has a day job and then occasionally he does a bit of getaway driving because he can make a bit of money out of it. He doesn't want to do it. He's trying to get away from it. But this whole book leads him up to it because what happens is at the start of the book, his personal and business debts start to pile up on him in a big way. His business is going down the tubes because there's a cheaper place opened up down the street and everybody's going off to do that. His grandmother's health care that he's trying to look after is all sort of coming apart because she didn't declare an insurance policy to the health care people and now they've thrown her a bill for $40,000, $50,000. His kids need school books. One of them needs their teeth done. It actually piles on a little bit too much. I mean, it's sort of like basically somebody throwing all this stuff on the poor guy. The debt's building up and up and up. And you know that he really has no choice. And so when two, a pair of low-life white trash brothers comes to see him and with the idea that they've got this inside knowledge about a jewellery delivery going to a particular jeweller shop where the safe is pretty flimsy and that they will be able to get in and get away, but it's fairly close to a police station and they need to have somebody who can really drive a car, then he gets in, he gets involved, and off he goes. And there's some brilliant piece of writing here about a real cinematic car chase where he basically gets away, gets it all fixed up, everything's done really well. It doesn't quite go, the heist doesn't quite go as it should.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. And so, but they get away with it. And then when he's back home, and he's back home and he's safe and he's watching the news, and he finds out that the news is reporting it as an attempted robbery in which nothing was taken. And yet he knows they have all these diamonds. And so you go, oh, okay. That's a bit cliched in the sense that you know now that really what it is, it's he's basically hit a mafia drop somewhere along the line and that he's going to be in trouble. So things follow along from that. What did I like about it? I like some of the real, the good action writing with this. I thought the characters were pretty well delineated and well drawn. A lot of people are going to really like this particular book. I'm certain it's going to get picked up for a film adaptation, and hopefully they basically crunch it a bit and clean up a lot of the bit at the start, because he piles too much stuff on at the beginning, and it really gets to the point where you think, no, it's just a bit too much going on here. But look, I only gave it 3.4 because I thought that, you know, it needed to be tightened up. This guy's a good writer and he's going to get better, I think. He'd be one to watch. And worthwhile reading if you like those sort of action thrillers, road movies, if you like.
All right. That sounds all right. All right. Well, this is the book I'm going to talk about is a complete change of pace from that. And this is a book called The Spy of Venice by Bennett Brandreth. Now, I was put onto this book by my wife, who listened to it as an audiobook, and she recommended it, and it sounded interesting. So I went off and bought the ebook version, because I don't have the time these days to, or the commute during which I can listen to audiobooks. So it had to be an actual physical book or an ebook. All right, so The Spy of Venice, it's historical fiction. But it's that type which blends in elements of the crime and thriller genres. So it reminded me a lot of ways of the Matthew Shadlake books by C.J. Sansom, set in the time of Henry VIII, which are excellent. Now, this one's set a little bit later. It's during the reign of Elizabeth I. And the main interest is that the protagonist of the book is a young bloke with the name of William Shakespeare. And he's described in the dramatis personae at the start as a shrewd-faced lad who might have made something of himself in the glove trade, were it not that his mind wandered. So, yes, this is William Shakespeare, the playwright, but it's a very different look at his life and experiences. Now, as the book opens, he's only 20 years old, but he's already has a wife and three children, and he's working as a glover in his father's business in Stratford, and he's bored out of his wits with that work. And eventually he has a bit of a wandering eye for the ladies, and when he gets into trouble after seducing the daughter of the steward of the local lord, he has to leave Stratford and flee to London. And he does so in the company of a band of travelling players, of course. Anyway, but in London, they don't give up very much work in London, and through a complicated series of circumstances, he becomes involved with a gentleman called Sir Henry Carr, who has been appointed as ambassador to the Serene Republic of Venice. Now, England at the time, with Queen Elizabeth on the throne, is beset on all sides by its enemies, particularly Philip of Spain, who hates England, and within a few years will launch the Armada, the Spanish Armada. And so Sir Henry is travelling to Venice to seek the alliance and the financial assistance of the wealthy Republic of Venice. And so William ends up as one of a group of players accompanying Sir Henry. And these include the fat old Nicholas Oldcastle, on whom Shakespeare based his character Falstaff, and the solid, dependable John Hemmingses. Now, then things get complicated because, of course, there are powerful forces determined to stop Sir Henry's mission succeeding. And the embassy is attacked not long after it passes Torino on their way to Venice, or Turin, I suppose you should say. And William and Nick Oldcastle alone manage to escape the slaughter, but not before Sir Henry Carr has passed on his papers to William and told him of the importance of the mission, stresses how vital it is to England that the mission goes ahead. And William promises to try and deliver the papers to the Doge of Venice. So I won't get into all the details by any means, but in Venice there are complicated intrigues, murders, poisonings, and schemes, and it turns into a pretty well-written thriller, I think. And the William Shakespeare character isn't there just for his name. The author does actually show that he can use his skills as a poet and a writer and as an actor to good effect as part of the plot. And I particularly like the fact that in Venice there's a strong, intelligent, and talented female character emerging in the form of someone called Isabella Lizzaro, who is one of the Cortigiana Onesta, the honest courtesans of Venice. And she plays a critical role in the story. Now, I saw Perry being skeptical before because I can see him on Zoom, you see. And in the hands of another writer, this story could have been a lightweight, inauthentic bit of historical fluff. But Brandreth really definitely knows his history and his Shakespeare. In fact, he's regarded as an expert on Shakespeare's language and times. He's been the rhetoric coach to the Royal Shakespeare Company and other theatre groups, and he's a performer in his own right. It also turns out that he's a leading intellectual property lawyer. So the story and the setting of the book all feels very authentic, and the book's afterword outlines the historical background and identifies the real-life historical figures who appear in the book or who are represented by fictional characters. And Brandreth explains that there's an unexplained period in Shakespeare's life of at least 3, perhaps as much as 7 years after he leaves Stratford and before he became a well-known actor and playwright in London. And so he fills in this gap with this pretty exciting tale, which also helps to account for Shakespeare's really close knowledge of Italian settings and stories, some of which were not published in England until much later than the Shakespeare's plays. And he also cleverly includes lots of bits of dialogue which sound very familiar if you know Shakespeare's plays. And you can sort of imagine that William's memory of these conversations has inspired parts of his later work. I liked it a lot. And there's a sequel, which I must get to, which is called The Assassin of Verona, which I think is about William and his friends getting back to London. So, yeah, I liked it a lot.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I will certainly basically point my wife towards that.
Yeah, she'd like it, I think.
All right. My next one is The Survivors by J.N. Harper. Now, I know, David, that you have spoken about this at length on the podcast. So I won't say a huge amount about it other than just to give some pointers about what I thought was good and maybe not so good about the particular book. But just as a reminder to the listener, this is Jane Harper's 4th novel, and it's set in the fictitious town of Evelyn Bay on the coast of Tasmania, and it's one of those places where everything fires up massively during summer, and then at the end of summer everybody just disappears and things get a little bit cold, and it's only the locals floating around. And we're at the fag end of summer here when Kieran Elliott, who used to live in the town, has returned with his partner, Mia, and the baby daughter, coming back to so that Kieran can help his mother pack up the house because the father has got dementia, has to leave the town and go somewhere like Launceston or somewhere like that to go to a aged care facility. As it happens, the day after Kieran turns up, a young woman who's passing through the town and has been working in the local pub is found dead on the beach. And this brings back memories of a missing girl from 10 years before, which is one of the reasons why Kieran basically decided to leave the town in the first place. And so the whole of the book basically looks at what happened in the past and what is happening currently in terms of the murder investigation into this young woman. Now, as it happened, I read this and then shortly thereafter went to see the film adaptation of The Dry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which we should talk about at some point later on down the track. And it struck me that plots are very similar.
Yes.
You know, basically there's a lot of plot points here which are pretty much the same. Somebody going back to a town that they've left under dubious circumstances. There was something in the past which is now coming up forward, and there's somebody died in the foreground in the present. And I thought, okay, you could do this a second time. Please don't do it a third time. Don't do it a third time. There's a bit too much in Australia at the moment, to me, just looking at some of the things that are on television and some of the books that I'm seeing around the place, there's a bit too much of a person who's left a small country town going back to that country town and everything that they had was going on when they were younger is now starting to resurface.
Yep.
This seems to be a common plot line that seems that floating around in Australian crime and television and dramatic. Time to move on for it, guys. Try and find something else. Just try and let's try and do something a little bit different. So, look, I actually thought this book was too long. I thought it was very slow to kick off. She's basically put a large number of more characters in to this book than were in the dry in the original, and she wants to show you every single interconnection between all of the different characters. She does that incredibly well. She's a really good writer, but sometimes you basically need to have somebody behind you to say no, too much, don't go too far. And I think she went just a little bit too far on this one. I think if you like The Dry and you like that sort of style, you'll really like this particular book. She's delivered again, really, and I think she's going to do very well. It's going to sell mozzas all over the place. But I gave it a 3.8 out of 5. There's just a couple of quibbles that I had with it, which sort of dragged it down a little bit. But she's still a writer that's worth watching. I'm thinking this one, she seems to have a little trouble with those even numbers. I mean, the second book wasn't that good, and this one... Not up to the standard of the first and the third. So anyway, I'll keep watching her and see how she goes in the future.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And if you remember when I did a little bit of a review of this book, I also mentioned the fact that there was this common theme I saw happening not only in her books but in a number of other books, as you say, Australian books, of the character going back to the town, often a coastal town. And then things pop up like this. So yeah, there is a bit too much of that sort of a plot line. Which yeah, I mean, if there's nothing original in any fiction, but it's kind of what you do with it. But sometimes if you don't make it original enough on a common basis, then it's not so good.
Well, we're just starting to notice it.
Yeah, that's probably
when you start to come up and you go, oh, hang on a minute. There's the broken shore, the dry.
Yeah, we've probably read too much, Perry.
And maybe we do, but I'm not the only one. I've heard other people I've heard other reviews of things. There's a new TV comedy on ABC TV at the moment about a celebrity chef that has a bit of a problem in his Michelin-starred restaurant in Shanghai and has to come back to the Adelaide Hills. Because he's lost everything and people have sued the ass off him and things have fallen apart and he has to go home. And you sort of think, well, that's sort of similar here as well. Now, that one's played for laughs and I gather it's more about the guy, well, he's not going back to solve a crime, but it's more about him going back and basically getting the rough edges knocked off him so that he's basically brought down to size. But... similar sorts of approaches. There's got to be another way of looking at some of this stuff, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to move on to my next one, which is a book called Waiting for Elijah by Kate Wilde. Now, this isn't a novel. It's a non-fiction work. I suppose you'd probably say it fits into the true crime category, although whether there was a crime committed or not is a real question of the book. So it fits into this crime episode anyway, I think, because it does have a great deal to do with the police and in particular how they deal with mentally ill individuals. So Kate Wilde, just to give a bit of background, Kate Wilde is a journalist who's worked with the ABC and she's won several awards for her work, including 3 Walkley Awards for excellence in journalism. It was her reports on juvenile detention in the Northern Territory which led to a Four Corners story and then the calling of a royal commission into those matters. Now, this book, Waiting for Elijah, is based on a story that Wilde originally reported on for Four Corners. And there was an incident in July of 2009 when a young man called Elijah Holcomb was shot dead by a police officer in Armidale, New South Wales. Now, Elijah, who was in his early 20s, and he was suffering from mental illness and had been for some years, since his mid-teens. He was on medication for it, but didn't always take the medication, and his problems came and went. So Elijah was at times subject to paranoid delusions. He was convinced that the FBI or the CIA were hunting him and that the police were out to get him. Now, on the day before his death, he'd taken his father's car without permission, and he'd driven from Narrabri, where his family was, to Armidale without letting the family know what he was doing. And so they reported him as a missing person to the police, but they strongly emphasised to the police that he wasn't a danger to anybody and that they just wanted to have him found and kept safe. And they stressed to the police that Elijah was very fearful of police, so that they shouldn't approach him, they should just keep an eye on him and let the family know so that they could go and pick him up. But unfortunately, what happened in reality was very different. Without going into a lot of detail, which of course is covered in the book, Elijah slept in his father's car overnight in Armidale, and then in the morning he went to the Armidale hospital seeking help for his mental illness, but he was turned away. He then went to the police station and told them that the car had been stolen, that he'd stolen the car, and he asked for their help to get into the hospital to be treated for the condition. And they took a couple of policemen, took him there and left him there, but he waited for a long time without being seen and eventually gave up and left. Meanwhile, two police officers had been tasked with simply locating the car, finding it where it was on the streets of Armidale. However, while doing that, they encountered Elijah, and one of them began to chase him through the streets of Armidale. Now, you can imagine that Elijah has these paranoid delusions, he's terrified of police. Now he's being chased by the police, and so he was, you know, scared out of his wits. And he runs through a cafe, and on the way he picks up, in the kitchen of the cafe, he picks up a bread knife. And the police officer, Andrew Rich, then corners Elijah in a laneway without his partner being with him. And according to Andrew Rich's testimony, he told Elijah to drop the knife repeatedly, told him to drop the knife. And again, according to his testimony, but not reliably supported by the very few witnesses of the event, Elijah then made a move to run towards him, towards the police officer, at which point Andrew Rich shot him dead. Now, the author was deeply moved by this story and was engaged with it for several years. The case was dealt with by the coroner at an inquest, who eventually referred it to New South Wales Police to determine if charges should be laid against the officer, Andrew Rich. The police department took a year to decide against charging him, and then the inquest reopened. Now, Kate Wilde, throughout the book, she tells of her repeated attempts to get in touch with Andrew Rich to ask him to tell his side of the story. But in the end, Rich decided not to speak to her, which is a pity. Anyway, however, she expands her discussion to look at how the police deal with mentally ill individuals in general across Australia, and something that they have to do on a very regular basis. And she looks at a number of other cases around Australia where disturbed individuals have been killed by police. In particular, she talks about the case of Tyler Cassidy, who was shot dead by police in Melbourne in what appears really to have been an instance of suicide by a cop. Tyler was taunting the police to shoot him. In doing this, though, she's not very critical of the police. She actually demonstrates enormous sympathy for the police as well as for the victims and their families. But she does have this empathy for what the police are going through, who generally had been poorly trained as to how to handle these situations. And when such instances like this occur, like the deaths of Elijah Holcomb and Tyler Cassidy, when those things occur, the police involved can often be very, very severely affected, mentally affected, and suffer from mental problems because of this, of what has happened. And so Kate Wilde herself, later in the book, she actually attends a four-day training course for police in New South Wales, a course which was developed in response to such tragedies occurring. And she describes how challenging that course was. And throughout the book, Kate Wilde also tells about her own struggles with mental illness in the form of depression, and something which her mother also suffered from. And so she ties herself into the story. So I thought it was very well worth reading this book. It's very thought-provoking and very, very informative. It's a good book.
It's very much a major problem. And, the number of things that you covered, you keep on hearing them about in the news I won't say quite regularly, because that makes it sound like it's happening about every week, but more regularly than you want it to have happen. And it's just, there's nothing you can say, because whatever you say is going to sound trite. So it sounds like a book that is definitely worth reading to see what is being done from that regard, just to keep ourselves informed.
Yep.
But it is a national tragedy.
Mm.
Okay, so I'll move on to come to mine. My next one. I've every now and again, David, as you know, I like going back and having a look at some of the old classic crime novels that have been published way back in the past. You know, the Sherlock Holmes era and all the way right through. And I've looked at a bit of Patricia Highsmith, which I think she's fantastic. So I'll be going back and looking at some more of her work later on. But today I'm going to be looking at a book from 1905.
Goes back away.
Contemporaneously with things like Hound of the Baskervilles. And this is The Four Just Men by Edgar Wallace.
Uh-huh.
And this is the first in a series by Edgar Wallace about the four just men, which inside the first chapter, I thought that was a very funny title, purely on the basis that starts off with three and ends with three.
Okay.
And the fourth one that's in here is really a sort of a temp. I think there was a fourth, but he's disappeared or died or something. And so they've got this other guy in who's come in as the four just men. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. It's just an odd title, I thought. I thought that was just a bit amusing. Now, anyway, the four just men of the title basically are vigilantes.
Okay.
They've got themselves set up. They're these really rich, well-connected people in Europe, and they've set themselves up as vigilantes who have murdered various men of power around the world who these men consider deserve their fate.
Okay.
Now, in other words, basically, in the early part of the 20th century, they were probably thought of, oh, yeah, on the side of truth and justice. In the 21st century, these guys are terrorists.
Yeah, well, that's right.
That's it. They're just terrorists. You don't have the right to go and basically summarily kill somebody because they're not doing what you want them to do. That's murder and terrorism and assassination. And no, we don't do that.
No, no.
But anyway, it's just interesting to have a look at this because this was sort of almost accepted as being, yeah, sounds like a pretty good idea. Anyway, so this particular novel is based around a threat that the just men have made to the British Foreign Secretary that unless he withdraws a plan to introduce the an aliens extradition political offences bill, that they are going to kill him, and they're going to kill him at a particular time. And they give him two or three different warnings. And the lead up to that is, you know, really quite good. If you step back away from the idea of, you know, it's glorification of terrorism and just look at it as being a sort of a dramatic, tension-filled novel, then it starts to move a little bit and you're okay. But it's always tough to sort of put the politics to one side here. So putting that aside, this is the moral issues aside. It is a tense story told from an unusual viewpoint. Mostly the characters are mainly flat. It's all about the action as opposed to the characters getting any better. They don't get any better. They're exactly the same from the start to the beginning. They think they're justified all the way right through. But it's really interesting to read this as a classic crime novel from the very early parts of the 20th century. It's very often listed as one of the major works in the field and is actually included in the Guardian 1000 novel list. And in that novel list of 1,000, there's about 140, 150 crime novels, and it's one of those.
Okay.
So from a historical perspective, very interesting to read. Pulpy, politically, not so good. I gave it a 3.2 out of 5. Worthwhile reading if you want to basically get a bit more interest in the history of the field.
Hmm.
But that's really about it.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I looked at Wallace a little while ago and thought I might tackle one of his or a couple of his books for Standard eBooks, but not quite sure yet whether I'll do that or not. There's probably a lot many better books to tackle first.
I wouldn't tackle this one or this series. And I gather that later on, the four just men end up turning into sort of Sherlock Holmes lookalikes. They're basically private detectives for hire later on. You sort of, that's a bit of a change from going around sort of putting a bullet in the back of some guy's head or hanging somebody in a square, which they do.
Oh, dear. Okay. Yeah, I might give that one a miss, I think.
Yeah, odd book. But I'm glad I read it.
I mean, well, look, it's important, I think, to look back at the origins of the genre, you know, the where the genre has come from. And where it might go to. So it's always interesting to look back at those sort of things.
It's sort of the equivalent of going back and having a look at things like the Time Machine
Mm,
and,
yeah.
you know, the Jules Verne material, just to basically get a view about where things came from and how things progressed from there to where we are now, what stuff was in the field. So from that perspective, it's interesting.
Oh, okay. That's all right. All right. Well, I'm going to have a double header now because I'm going to talk about two books in one chunk, if you like. Basically, because the two books are closely linked. And so these books are Good Girl, Bad Girl and When She Was Good by Michael Rowbotham. Michael Rowbotham, as people probably know, is an Australian-born writer who lived for a long he lived for a long time in the UK, in the United Kingdom, where he worked as a journalist. He eventually did very well in journalism, eventually became the deputy features editor for the Mail on Sunday newspaper. And then he became a freelancer, and he did quite a bit of work as a ghostwriter, and he wrote the quote autobiographies unquote of a number of very celebrated people. And he then returned to Australia in 1996, and then he wrote his first novel, which was The Suspect. And he's since written, I think, at least 15 novels. He's probably got several more about to be published, but anyway, the ones that are listed on Wikipedia, I think, is 15. And they're all in this crime thriller genre. They're mostly set in the United Kingdom. He hasn't written anything so far, I don't think, yet set in Australia. So they're all set in the United Kingdom, generally around London.
There's one I think that is set in the U.S. that he won a major award for over there,
Okay.
but
I
I
haven't read
can't
that.
remember the title of it offhand, but
Yeah.
it was pretty
Oh,
good.
yeah. Okay. I haven't read that one. Anyway, having said that, they're set around London. The particular books I'm going to talk about today, I think, are set around Nottingham. But never mind. With The Suspect and nine other of his novels, they all have a psychologist called Joseph O'Loughlin, either as the first-person narrator or he's featured as an important secondary character in those books. Now, O'Loughlin, this psychologist, works closely with the police, which leads to him becoming entangled in various criminal cases. And I say entangled because in the very first novel in the series, O'Loughlin himself becomes the suspect. He's on the run and hunted by the police, which is it's a good book. Anyway, all of this is a very long way around to talking about these two novels, which have been written in what's touted as by the publishers as being a brand new series. Now, this series features as the first-person narrator a psychologist who works closely with the police. At which point you say, "Hang on a minute, haven't we been here before?" Anyway, we'll go from there. The protagonist of these books is called Cyrus Haven. He's a fairly young man; he's in his 30s. And the first novel starts with Cyrus being asked to observe and comment on a teenager called Evie Cormack. And she's in an institution called Langford Hall, which accommodates juvenile offenders. And she's an orphan, he's told, who's been placed in a dozen different foster homes, but she's always run away or she's been sent back by the fostering family who can't stand her. So she's antisocial, aggressive, dyslexic. I can't even say that. Dyslexic, but apparently intelligent. And so Cyrus is intrigued, but not entirely sure why he's being brought in to comment about it. One thing in particular intrigues Cyrus about Evie. She claims to be always able to tell whether someone is lying to her. And indeed, she's able to demonstrate that to him. So it emerges that Evie isn't the girl's real name. In fact, no one knows her real identity, though in a sense, she's famous. And Cyrus is told in strict confidence that Evie is the girl who was found about 7 years previously, living in a secret room on the top floor of a house in London. And what's more, in one of the main rooms of the house, police discovered the decomposing body of a man who, it appears, has been tortured to death. And the girl either refuses or is unable to shed any light on what happened to him, where she'd been, why she was concealed, her real name, how old she was, or where her family was. And now the press, when this girl, young girl was discovered sort of ragged and dirty living in this secret room, the press went wild over the story, this kind of story. You can imagine they would. And which is why the girl was given, because she was only, 11 or 12 or something, not even younger, I think 10 or 11. So they went wild over the story, which is why the girl was given a new name and all the details for a new identity and location have been suppressed by the courts. No one's allowed to publish it. So at the point where that we're Cyrus gets involved. Evie is petitioning the courts to be released from Langford Hall and allowed to make a life for herself. Now, if she was 18 years old, then she could demand that as a right. But no one knows her real date of birth. And so they're not prepared to let her go. So she is given legal representation, and she does make her appeal to a judge who refuses to let her go immediately, but decides to establish for her a legally binding notional date of birth about 6 months ahead, at which point she'll be considered to be 18 and able to be released unless she's declared insane and placed in involuntary psychiatric detention. Now, this latter course is being pushed for some by the officials at Langford Hall, who really don't like Evie and find her very violent and so on. But Cyrus is moved by the story and is so intrigued by Evie's character that he offers to foster her himself until the date is reached, this notional birth date is reached. And eventually this application is accepted by the court. I actually found that very unlikely, to be honest. This guy is a man in his 30s, single guy, living alone, and he's being allowed to foster a young girl in her teens in the house. Doesn't seem very likely to me. Anyway, if you let that go. So, obviously, Evie is the bad girl of the title of this book, Good Girl, Bad Girl. And the good girl is 15-year-old Jodie Sheehan, who went missing after a fireworks display one night and whose body has been found in a nearby wood. And Cyrus is called into that case officially by the police as a forensic psychologist to assist with the case, which of course becomes more and more complicated as the book goes on, more complicated than it first seems. And so we've got these two parallel, but both very interesting stories. And added to that, we discover that in Cyrus's background, there's also been a terrible family tragedy, which has gone a long way to shaping him, both in character and his choice of career. And now, there's a lot going on here, a lot of balls in the air, but Rowbottom is a master of juggling all these balls and keeping the reader engrossed. And naturally, Evie becomes involved with the case of the murder of Jodie Sheehan, which Cyrus is looking into, and that case comes to an unexpected conclusion. I didn't guess who had done that until that was until it was very close to the end. So that's all that is basically the first book, and you don't get in the first book much of an insight into the true story behind Evie. And that's really what happens in the second book. The second book, When She Was Good, that's when we do a really deep dive into Evie's past, and we begin to learn why Evie had been hidden away in the house and who was the man who was tortured in the neighbouring room. And powerful individuals from Evie's past seek her out, try to silence her permanently. So Cyrus Haven's again involved in trying to protect Evie and expose all these people who are responsible for her situation. It's good stuff, gripping stuff. Definitely recommend it. But yeah, you pretty much just need to read them, the two books as one thing.
Rowbottom is a good author that's worth watching. The book that I was talking about, the one that was set in the US, was titled Life or Death.
Okay.
And it won, what was it, from 2014. God, I've got 19 on the brain. From 2014, and it won the 2015 Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger Award, which is basically the major award given out by the Crime Writers Association in the UK for the best crime novel of the year published in the UK. So, bit of a change. It was obviously a standalone that he got together and did very well with, which is good. And I have read that, and I do recommend that one, David. Go and have a look at that.
Okay. Well, there's so many of his books. Yeah, there's so many of his books I still need to catch up with. I still haven't read all of the Joseph O'Loughlin series, so I'd like to complete that anyway.
Well, if you want a bit of a change, and instead of going with the same author and same character all the time, throw that one in the middle.
Sure, sounds good.
You still get the same author, and you get a different view.
Sure.
Well, I'm going for my last book again, back into time in crime history. But this is a bit of a strange one, because it's a Japanese locked room murder mystery. First published in 1946, but really wasn't translated into English until the last 4 or 5 years. Now, it's the very first in a series of 32 detective novels.
Good heavens.
Featuring, well, I should say it's the book is called The Honjin Murders by Saishi Yokomizo, and this is the first in the I'm really going to get these pronounced incorrectly. So
oh, well, look, our Japanese listeners will forgive you.
Kozuke Kindaichi. Kindaichi series. There's 32 of them. He's a young man who has basically always wanted to be a consulting detective in the mould of Sherlock Holmes, basically. But he doesn't follow along the same way that Sherlock Holmes does. He basically just puts all the pieces together but he does utilise the whole idea of, if you eliminate the impossible, whatever's left must be the truth. That basic idea. You start putting all the bits together and you say, well, that can't happen, so you get rid of that, even though it looks like it's the obvious one. That isn't the case. And you put this in together and put this in together. Anyway, so look, but the background of this is that it's told from a position 10 years in the future. So it's written in 1946, and it's looking back to 1937. So just pre-war, really. And it's set in the Japanese village of Okamura. And the main upcoming event, this is only a small little Japanese village, and the main upcoming event of interest to all is the wedding of the oldest son of the Ichiyangi family, which is the highest ranking family in the village. Now, they used to run the Honjin, which is a upper class inn of this particular village. Now, a Honjin was a village, was an inn that was in use during the shogunate up till about 1860, where people would travel from various parts of the country to go to Edo, which was the capital, to see the shogun, and they would stop in these honjin. They were the only ones that were allowed to stay in these upper-class inns. The general populace wasn't allowed to stay there, so they were high-level inns, high-level hostels that people stayed in, and the families that ran them were very high ranking in the village. Now, the eldest son's getting married. Of course, he's chosen a woman that the family don't particularly like, but they've come around to the view that, yeah, okay, look, he's desperate to get married, so that's what's going to happen. So they get married, they go back to their room, and in the middle of the night, somebody hears some screams. They go in and do investigate into the small cabin area where they're living, and they find out that the couple are both dead, slashed to bits with knives, and the place is completely locked up. There was no way for anybody to get out. And when they get in and find the dead bodies, they go looking around for the murder weapon and find out that it's outside the room and could not have got out there, supposedly, without having gone from inside the room to outside the room, but they can't work out how this is going to work. The local police become involved, but they're sort of floundering a bit. And as it happens, the uncle of the groom calls in his young friend, Kozuko Kindaichi, who's started to get a bit of a reputation around the traps as being a consulting detective, and he brings him in to help the local police to be able to work out what's happening. Now, this is a classic lockroom murder mystery, and there are a lot of rules about this, and oddly enough, it's very self-referential in the sense that both the lead detective and one of the family of the particular the family that we're dealing with are both major detective story fans.
Okay.
And so they read a lot of detective stories. And the detective, somebody says to him, well, so you a fan of it? He says, well, not particularly, but I just like reading it to get the ideas to see how they work their way through. So he name checks, you know, people like Agatha Christie, John Dixon Carr, Sherlock Holmes, all these other people. But he deals specifically very much with lockroom mysteries. So this is a wonderful piece of work. It just flows beautifully. It's just great. There's a really puzzling death, and he's like, okay, how does this work out?
Yeah, yeah.
But he comes up with a really good, satisfying, if rather complicated solution, but it all makes sense. All the clues are there, but of course you have to have everything intricately done, and you'd have to really be there to see it to be able to work out how it all fits together so that everything ends up being in exactly the right place at the right time and where it all goes to. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to come up with a solution yourself. So, you know, I'm reading this and I'm going, okay, that makes sense. That doesn't. But he basically gets there to the end. And it's really satisfying. Unfortunately, of these 32 books, only two of them have been translated into English.
That's a pity. Mm.
The first and the sixth.
Oh, my goodness.
Why do they do this? Mm. So I believe the sixth is out there somewhere, so I'm going to have to go and try and find it.
Well, of course, there's another solution, Perry. You just have to learn Japanese.
Yeah, righto. Dream on. These are good. This is a good book. This is a good book. I gave it 4.2 out of 5.
Yeah, that's very good.
You know, the solution's a bit convoluted, but hey, it's the fun of the thing. The whole point about it, these locker room mysteries, is that, you know, they're not really supposed to be something that's going to happen every day. This is just something that's really set up as a puzzle piece.
Yeah.
And because of that, you have to work out how this guy analyzes it and works his way all the way right through. He does it very well. And okay. I can recommend this one if you're at all interested in locker room murders. This is great.
That sounds good.
And with 32 books to go, I'm not going to be around by the time they've finished translating them all because they're probably going to do about one a year.
Yeah.
You know, that'll take me up to my late 80s or late 90s. I'm not going to get there.
No, afraid not.
But hopefully I'll get to read a few more of them down the track because it was good.
Sounds very good. Hmm. All right. Well, I think we've covered the ground pretty well here. A very large variety of different crime-associated or thriller-associated books and some things that sound well worth reading.
Hopefully people have got a few ideas about what to have a look at. And we do like to jump around a little bit in the crime field. There's some good stuff there, and it's just interesting that science fiction fans do have a tendency to be interested in the crime stuff as well. Mm. And it's sort of basically, I won't say it brings you back to reality, but it gives you a different viewpoint on particular plot lines. And it is interesting. It's also interesting when you see the crossover between the two, where you have a science fiction novel which is actually a mystery as well.
Yeah.
And some of those can be very good. And one of the locker room mysteries I'm thinking of, which I might have to discuss later on, is one of the one and only Lord Darcy novel. As you recall, the Randall Garrett Lord Darcy one, alternate history, where Richard the Lionheart does not die of his wounds in Jerusalem, but comes back to England and takes over the throne. So there's no King John, therefore there's no Magna Carta, therefore there's no Parliament. And basically that's where the alternate history splits off.
Mm.
And so you end up with magic being like a science. And the locker room murder mystery there is the death of a magician at a magician's convention.
That's right, yes, I remember.
And he's in a locker room, and it's called Too Many Magicians.
Too Many Magicians, that's right.
A wonderful book, really, really good.
It is a good book.
That is on my list to read this year, so I will get to it.
Yeah. It's interesting too, isn't it, when you talk about the crossovers that I think I've said this before on the podcast, that quite a few science fiction authors also write crime novels, and some of them were pretty good at it. I'm thinking of people like Frederick Brown and Jack Vance, like that. Yeah.
Roger Zelazny wrote some stuff. I'm sure that if you hunted around, you find that Silverberg wrote some stuff as well. There's a big crossover between the two. It comes from both of them being involved in the pulp magazines back in the 40s and 50s, and people were swapped over from one to the other. And that's fine, but it's just interesting to see how different plots are handled in different ways and in different settings. So that's good. So that's about it for this week,
I think,
David.
So, yeah. We've done a fair bit there.
Next time.
Yeah, well, next time's going to be a bit interesting, and we're going to take a bit of a divergence, and we're going to talk about some of the volunteer projects that we work on. And I'm going to go into a bit more detail about Standard eBooks, and I've got an interview lined up with the chap who started that. And Perry, I think, is going to talk about a number of things, including the work he does for Trove. So just to cover some ground there in terms of the kind of things we do outside of reading books and watching TV. We do work for people, which is good.
Yes, as the as that little bit of extra, and you pick up a lot of extra knowledge as well about the literary field by doing a bit of work around the edges and helping people out. And yeah, it's good. It's a good thing to be doing. Okay, that's it, David.
Indeed.
All right.
We'll
see you
in
a 2 weeks.
Yeah, fortnight's time. Okay.
Right,
thanks a lot.
See you then.
See you then. Okay, bye.